X gon' give it to you. Wait for you to get it on your own. X gon' deliver to you. Knock, knock, open up the door, it's real. With the non-stop, pop out from stainless steel.
Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse MLL podcast. It's kind of a sad podcast. It's like basically our last one of the year. MLL Champ happened this past weekend. We're going to recap that first. I'm Kyle Devitt. I'm the Gear and Lifestyle Editor at Inside Lacrosse. And I'm joined by my co-host, as usual,
Chris Rosenthal, Inside Lacrosse freelance contributor and MLL analyst.
And we are also joined today for the entire pod by a very special guest. I'll let him introduce himself.
Joe Keegan. I cover the MLL for Moneyball Lacrosse.
All right. First up, we got to recap this wild championship game. Ohio gets it done 17 to Denver's 12 goals, even though Denver looked like they had control for long portions of the game. We're up by one at the half. Joe, let me ask you first. What, in your mind, was the turning point for Ohio to win this game?
That late third quarter run, Peter Baum scored on a multiple pass goal. And then the real turning point for me was Kyle Harrison's goal as part of that run in that third quarter. Denver was kind of pulling away, up 10-6. And, you know, talking to the players on the field after the game, they were saying, you know, that was when they were kind of starting to feel a little bit nervous, down 10-6, that they really needed an answer. So they got one from Baum to make it 10-7, but the real turning point was that 10-8 goal by Kyle Harrison. Just McAneer tweeted about this. The look that Harrison gave the Ohio bench after that goal was just pretty much saying, I don't even know what he said. He might not have said anything. There were no words needed. The look that he gave said it all, that he wasn't letting them lose that game. And it really sparked, you know, a fourth quarter that was all Ohio.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. I've seen all these the Harrison pieces. Phil Shore wrote one for Lacrosse Magazine, as well as our own Matt Kinnear. And I remember when Denver went to the championship game, and it was Harrison's year, like when he was on that second line at Denver, and he was right before Alex M started. I believe it was 2009. And I remember looking at that lineup, that Denver team, when he was on there, and how like dejected he was in particular, as well as like, you know, Max Seaball was on that team. And it's wild. I actually talked to him after the game, and he was just like, I never thought that it would feel like this, which is awesome. Chris, what did you think was the turning point in the game for Ohio?
I was kind of looking at it a little more skeptically, I guess, from Ohio's standpoint, having seen what they had just kind of gone through as far as giving up, you know, goal after goal earlier. I thought it came a little bit later when Jake Bernhardt scored his first goal, just because, Peter Baum had kind of driven down towards the hash mark, and he had drawn the double, and they had taken advantage of Denver kind of sloughing a little too far off of the second guy. And in this case, it was Bernhardt. You know, Baum found him, and he was able to just kind of catch and shoot before Denver could get settled again. And, you know, right after that, you know, when Greg Fiskulgen scored his goal, and then we were all tied up back at 12. So I think just finally being able to take advantage more consistently of Denver kind of giving these guys a little too much room, maybe not enough respect on their shot. And then, you know, doubling that back up, you know, about 7 seconds later or so with the Fiskulgen. I think that's finally what really, really, really pushed them over the edge.
Yeah. I think for me, I believe it was a little earlier, the Bocklet slipping and not getting out to cover, I believe it was Baum, was one. But right before that, Mike Simon, if you read our Chris and I's real time rundown of the game, Mike Simon throws the ball back after he crosses the half line. It's a costly turnover, and Ohio gets a key possession back. That's just those two mistakes, even though like it's inches, it's feet. It's like one pass doesn't get there, a cleat doesn't catch, and the game is totally different for me. So it's interesting, you know, people talk about how epic games are, and you know, you look at the scoreline here. It's 5 goals. Ohio won by 5 goals. I don't think it was that close. It was that bad. I think it was much closer than that scoreline kind of suggests And one guy, I'm surprised you guys haven't brought him up, Mr. Holman, who Chris, I believe, tweeted, nobody hulks up like Marcus Holman. I want to talk about his clutch shots, because the natural hat trick in the MLL Championship, I struggle to find a better individual performance to win an MLL Championship in recent memory. What do you guys think?
So the thing I think that makes that so special was, you know, that he kind of went off under a tie game. You know, it's just 12-12 at that point. And so somebody to just do the natural hat trick on a 12-12 game is just insane, especially like a championship game. Stakes are high. That was just amazing. Eric Law had a ridiculous game last year. I think it's tougher to remember when you don't see all of the goals right, you know, one after the other like that. But like, if I was thinking of, you know, if we're going to put these on like a Mount Rushmore of, you know, killing it in a championship game or something like that, I was looking back at the game last year that I was watching last week, getting ready for this one. And, Denver had an 8-1 third quarter, and Law had 3 goals and an assist in that quarter. And he finished with the game winner. But like I said, when you're going to look at it later, it's definitely going to seem like, I mean, Holman just, he just took the whole thing over. And I mean, we're going to remember that forever.
Yeah, it was definitely, for a 6-point performance, look, there's probably been other 6-point performances in the championship game, but the timing of those goals, tied at 12 for him to just kind of pull up, he noticed that his hands were free. He wasn't really close to the cage. He just pulled up, stung the top corner. And that was the first goal of the run. It wasn't like he was already feeling it at that point. He just, you know, wanted to get his shot off, shoot or shoot. And he's one of the best in the league at, you know, finishing shots that his teammates create for him or creating his own shot when he gets that chance. So just the magnitude of, you know, Holman goal, Holman goal, Holman goal again, really made it in the moment feel like it was, you know, one of the best championship performances that we've seen.
So it's interesting. So obviously Matt Kinnear went down to cover it for Inside the Cross. Joe, you were down there. Fill me in on the atmosphere. Like tell me, paint a picture for the listeners about what it was like at the Star.
It was a great atmosphere that you just can't really replicate in an outdoor stadium. Like, for 7,500 was the reported crowd. It was probably a little less than that. They say it was 6,000. Capacity is 6,000 on each side. The one side wasn't entirely full, so it was probably more like 5,000 or 5,500, which is not atypical to see at a Cannons game, and I'm at every Cannons game of the year, and it does not get that loud. Even after Cannon's goals, and presumably everybody at Harvard Stadium is a Cannons fan, it does not get that loud. Just because it's an outdoor stadium, the acoustics of Harvard Stadium can't replicate the Star. I thought there was a good contingency of Denver fans and Ohio fans, but the neutral fans were so engaged for events that weren't just goals. Like Matt Kavanaugh, Marcus Holman riding back possessions, the crowd was going wild. Those kind of up and down plays where maybe a great shot opportunity was created, but, you know, fast break shot off the cage, you hear like the oohs and the ahs and like the uproars of the crowd. It was just, I've never heard an echo like that in an MLL game. So to kind of simulate, you know, like I guess, for comparison, the National Lacrosse League, like, they play indoors and they will have crowds other than like the Buffaloes or the Saskatchewans where they sell out. Their crowds just generally feel bigger because of the indoor acoustics. And I thought that's what it felt like playing at the Star indoors. I think Jake Steinfeld said during the broadcast that it was the first ever indoor MLL game. I can't think of another one to correct him on it. So I thought that aspect of it was really cool.
Yeah, MLL championship in an indoor arena. The irony is not lost. at least not on me. Let's go back to the game for real quickly. So my theory going into this game is that Denver is this massive chaotic entity that you cannot control them, but everyone tries to control them, and then they give up and start trying to run with them. Whereas Ohio is the team that is a controlling team. It's a ride the tempo team, but control the tempo team. I thought that Ohio did not play well in the first half. And if you go back again and read the real-time rundown, I was shocked that they weren't up. I thought they gave Denver a ton of chances, and much has been made of that Ohio defense. I thought they played badly in the first half, and that's crazy to say about a team that went on to win the MLL championship. But you have to think that this Ohio team, the defense in particular, is built on not making mistakes. And every Denver goal in the first half was an Ohio mistake. So how did that flip, and what did Denver do wrong to kind of let this game slip away, in your opinion? Chris, you can take this one first.
You know, I think what Denver did wrong towards the end is kind of what – it's pretty much exactly what they're doing wrong at the beginning. Their earlier goals were just kind of situations where – Ohio players were getting by them, and they weren't, you know, they're paying too much attention to sliding over or to ignoring this guy in favor of another guy, or, you know, like in it, especially like in a championship setting, you have to be fully aware that there are going to be heroes, you know what I mean? And they might not necessarily be the guy who shows up on the stat sheet, the guy you came into the game instructed to worry about. Like early in the game, it was the second goal. Pat Harbison essentially just kind of walks between two players, and neither of them were. It was kind of like Jeremy Sievert seemed to kind of maybe pass him along, and BJ Grill was kind of sliding up towards him, but it was a hesitant sort of slide. I think they were both too concerned with it being Harbison and not concerned enough with it being someone with the ball. And I think what happened in that situation was they said, well, I want to stick with this assignment. And, you know, it came back to bite them. Similar thing with Greg Piskulligin's goal in the fourth quarter. You know, they let him come walking in. And I understand you're picking your poison with everybody else. But the man with the ball, especially in a championship situation, you know, some people want that pressure on themselves. You know, Greg Piskulligin's like, hey, I'm going to take this. I'm going to make it happen by myself. And they didn't seem to account for that sort of thing. And it was just a lot of their goals were just situations where they were not paying close enough attention to prioritizing the one particular person with the ball. Like Marcus Holman's first of the three goals, they set up in a situation where they sent a short stick out to shut off Tom Schreiber. And if you're watching like a replay of the game, you can't even see Schreiber in the camera because he's not, you know, he's over at like the 30-yard line or something like that. You can't even see him. But so in that situation, he's just gone, and it's a 4-on-4. But there still isn't somebody on Holman's hands. There's still a slide coming over to Holman. And so that's why in that whole play it's set up, Holman just kind of looks and says, okay, Schreiber's, you know, 15 yards behind me covered. All right, well, I'm just going to rip this. And I think that's what happened with Denver. They just got a little too concerned with maybe more of like a planning. They got a little too plan heavy and not reflex heavy enough. And I think that's ultimately what did it to them.
Joe, what do you think?
I think offensively, Denver kind of got away from what they do well and played right into Ohio's hands, Ohio's defense's hands. Like you said, a lot of Denver's goals early were off, you know, Law had the defense hung up. Kavanaugh had the ride back. There was a broken stick there that gave him a quick 6-on-5. But when it was really settled down 6-on-6, Denver was doing a lot of one-on-one stuff. That kind of stuff's just not going to work against Ohio. They like all their matchups on the field. All their poles can cover. Dominique Alexander is one of the best short stick defenders in the league. So you're not really going to have a great day going against him. Denver plays a lot of like two man, not exactly like pick and roll, but more like a two man shallow cuts and two man exchanges. Kind of like a rub play that you'd see on the goal line in the NFL to create that miscommunication and change the way that the defense slides. When you let Ohio slide as a six-man unit, you know, you get those five guys playing off ball. They're just the best defense in the league. They're the best defense against one-on-one dodges in terms of efficiency. They're the fifth best defense against those two-man situations. They have a tendency to play a little overly aggressive, double team the ball. Sometimes that leaves the roll man open. I thought that Denver would test that a little more. But instead we saw a lot of Severs putting his head down, getting downhill. We saw a lot of Romar one-on-one. I think when the dust settled, you know, and the Outlaws really had to work to draw slides and replicate the chaos that they thrive so well in, they had a lot of trouble doing that because they weren't really going to the right matchups. I thought Berg, Kavanaugh, and Currier were the right guys to beat their man and create those unsettled situations out of the settled situations. And, you know, they didn't give those guys the ball enough, and they didn't work those two-man games.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I thought Kavanaugh played as good as anybody in the game. I mean, I know that Denver lost, but I, in the piece that we wrote, I was like, Kavanaugh is having the game of his life. Like, this dude needs some recognition. I have in here, what did Ohio do right? But I want to twist that question a little bit while I have you guys here. I'm getting into a time machine. I'm going to go back to 2012. I'm going to tell both of you that Ohio is going to win the championship in 5 years. Do you believe me? In 2012. Don't lie.
I'm going to say, if you said that in 2012, I would say yes. Just kind of by the nature of Major League Lacrosse, I feel like if you're going to, if you do it right, and if you're going to be bad, you should be able to cash in on that badness. And, you know, I mean, just the way that it's not so much a situation where we have these kind of, you know, legacy teams that stay awesome all the time. I mean, we do have Denver, which seems to be kind of the, you know, shining example of making the playoffs and things like that. But the spots are generally up for grabs. So, you know, a league this size, if just a sport like lacrosse, I would think if you can have a couple good drafts, there shouldn't be anything specifically anchoring you to the bottom. I would definitely be like, well, you know, okay, we'll see. You know, some things are going to have to change, but all right, we'll see.
What do you think?
Yeah, I got to agree. I got to agree for the same reasons. I know sometimes I'm kind of like a huge optimist for some of these teams, you know, but any of these teams, like Florida went from worst to a playoff team. We've seen it happen. It's certainly not unprecedented. Boston is in rough shape right now. They finished last this year. But you look at that roster, there are nice pieces on it. And, you know, I asked a few weeks ago, I was asking around, asking some coaches what they think of Boston, you know, like what's their path to competing. One of them just said, look, every team in this league is one offseason away. That's all it takes is one draft class, one trade. You bring in the right guys, the right culture. I definitely would not have predicted the path that Ohio took to the championship, but you got to believe that, you know, when you get the right people in the front office, you get a couple of the right leaders, which Ohio certainly did, on the that you can turn it. Really any team into a championship team in this league.
I'm going to be real with you guys. If I came out of a time machine talking to myself and myself was like, yo, Ohio's going to win, I would have laughed in my own face. I would have been like, this team? The way this team is run? Really? Because it's funny. Like, you guys are obviously way more optimistic than me about pretty much everything in life, and especially the MLL. So that's good. That's why we have a podcast and we can exchange ideas. I just think that, yes, a great draft class can flip a team. But I don't think it flips it to a championship. I think the players do that and the team facilitates that. And there are teams in the league that are so poor at facilitating and helping that culture grow that that's the thing that has to change. And it's not the players a lot of the time. And it just in my, you know, kind of thought process and experience with all the teams in the league for as long as I've been covering it, the culture of the team changes first and then the player comes and then the wins come and then the championship comes. And with Ohio, it's interesting because, again, 5 years ago, they were awful. They were awful. And I'm not talking like they couldn't score goals, they couldn't stop goals. I'm talking like they couldn't even get like enough dudes to show up and like play real games. So for them to totally flip that culture with, I think you guys are right, with a lot, a huge talent infusion. And by the way, it's really easy to screw up the first round of the MLL draft and the second round. You know what I mean? So all the credit in the world, I'm not trying to take credit away from them. I'm actually giving them more because I would not have believed 5 years ago that this Ohio team was going to win a championship. I don't even know how many guys on this team were on the team 5 years ago. Like two, three? Like Holman and Baum? Is that it? Are they even there yet? Like it's a wild kind of thing to totally look at a team that has a completely different identity 5 years later and then they win the championship. It's one of the great things about Major League Lacrosse. And with that, we're going to move on to basically the rest of the podcast is going to be our reflections of the 2017 Major League Lacrosse season. Obviously, all three of us love the league. We cover it in different ways. We do different things. We have all different writing styles. I want to ask you first the overarching question. And I'll ask Joe first. Joe, did this season deliver on the promise of it before it started?
The play on the field absolutely delivered. The players have been getting better every year because, I mean, you guys know this, but there are just so many more who are full-time lacrosse guys, maybe not full-time MLL, but full-time as in their outside of MLL job is assistant coaching or they have a sponsorship or they run camps. So as more players get into that, I feel like the product on the field continues to improve. Anybody who critiques that aspect of it or says that it's a roll the ball out kind of league certainly hasn't watched in a while. And maybe that's the problem. Maybe more people need to watch and more people need to be able to watch. I think that is the one part of the season that maybe didn't deliver. The beginning of the year, there was a lot of kind of backlash or, you know, people disappointed when they learned that the games weren't going to be on ESPN3. Because even though this was the second year of LSN, last year, the games that weren't being aired live on LSN were available on ESPN3. So people could go watch them if they wanted to. Now, it was just LSN, except for the Twitter game of the week, which I thought really kind of it really helped to hush the noise that was created by those games not being on ESPN3. I thought it gave people their fix. If you're like me, one game a week of this league is definitely not enough to reach your fix. You need more. So I hope more people tuned in to the rest of the games because of the Twitter game of the week. But just from, you know, the engagement that we get on Twitter during the games, throughout the week, it just feels like the audience wasn't there this year, which is tough. It's tough to see for the players and the coaches and some of the people working in the league who put in so much time. So on that front, it didn't deliver. But the play on the field delivered. It will deliver again next year. It always delivers. That you can count on. That's the rock.
Chris?
Yeah, no, I definitely have to echo what Joe said on both accounts. On field, I thought the play was, you know, exciting, outstanding, super high level of lacrosse being played from the best lacrosse players. And I think they have to push themselves each year because it's not a league that is, you know, expanding at this, you know, unsustainable rate. And so what happens is every year they're just getting more and more young players coming in. So, you know, if you're a fourth year player in the league and you might have been doing a great job so far, but all of a sudden, you know, you have, you know, the guy who wins the, you know, 2018 Tuarton is joining your team. And so, you know, as good as you thought you were, you have to be better. And so I think all the players are aware of this, especially as so many more of them are entering sort of, you know, full-time lacrosse elements in their lives. It's like they have to get better or they have to get real jobs. You know, like they're all just fighting for these gigs at this point. You know, it's not like we have 15 teams. You know, you can get cut, you know, all the time. Better guys are lining up. So I think that kind of fosters the need to constantly improve the on-field product. And I think that's what we're seeing. Off-field, I agree. I think having game on Twitter was great. I enjoyed watching it on Twitter. I enjoyed the fact that there's a sort of a community atmosphere to having games on Twitter that, you know, everybody's right there so we can all talk about the game. And I know there were casual viewers who would, you know, like say to me, like, hey, how am I watching a lacrosse game on Twitter right now? You know, who didn't follow the MLL or anything like that. But, you know, all of a sudden they know there's a game on just because they happen to be going to Twitter. And I think that's a huge element of promoting this league. You need people who aren't looking for it to find it. So I think getting games on Twitter was very big. And, you know, if it can continue to progress in a positive manner, I think that's something that people might look back at as something that was pivotal to the growth of Major League Lacrosse. But yeah, I definitely agree. On field, delivered, fantastic. Games mattered the whole season again, much like last year. And off field, plenty of issues. I think I'm sure we'll probably get to those shortly. But I will hand it back over to you. Kyle, what did you think?
Yeah.
On field and off delivered?
We will get into production. It's the next topic. I just think that, you know, overall, and we're going to be all of the same mind on this, the players make the league. You know, the players deserve more credit than any of us could ever give them. You know, and when I first started covering the league, I was very critical of players and I would find weaknesses and that's part of my pessimistic nature, but also as a coach, that's what I would do. I would identify the weakness of an opponent and I translated that into the writing. And as time has gone on, I've kind of realized that yes, it's actually almost easy for me to do that. And I shouldn't do that. I should actually look at the things that are great about the league to promote the league. Because the league needs us. They do. Like they need us way more than we need them. I honestly believe that. And and I'm speaking about media in general, not us three, although I think that's probably true for us three as well, that they need someone to like spread the gospel of this league because people do still think it's a beer league. And they're wrong. They're so wrong. If you're listening to this and you think that, I just like, I can't tell you how wrong you are. It's not a debate. Like you have no leg to stand on. It's not true anymore. It's flat out not true. So from that perspective, I really do believe that the league is getting better with and the players that are playing now are the best players to ever play lacrosse, which sounds like I'm trying to be hyperbolic. I'm not. I believe that. These are the best athletes that have ever played lacrosse. They're playing right now. You know, this generation of players that's coming up would destroy the generation of players 20 years ago because the athleticism is so different. It's an era. We're entering into a golden age of lacrosse, and MLL is leading that charge, and I think that can't be overlooked at all. Off-field stuff, if they didn't have Twitter Game of the Week, I think it would have. This whole season would have been a complete failure. Like I believe that the Twitter game saved the league because it gave you know, incidental relevance to the league to people that didn't know it was around. And that is the most important thing. That probably helped make fans, if they saw the right game with the right production. I mean, you guys remember back in July, I believe, we had a weekend where three of the four games went to overtime and the other game was a one-goal game. Like, that, it doesn't get more exciting than that if you're a lacrosse fan in general. You know, I just feel like you can't dispute that anymore. Let's move on to production. I mean, let's talk, like, what needs to be fixed that, like, is obvious. I feel like this is an easy question, and I'm sure we all have the same answer. Chris, take it first.
So you're talking about the Twitter games, and I definitely agree. And I think on that same notion, when you're in front of who knows however many thousands upon thousands of people who are stumbling across your product, you have to make sure everything is properly tightened. You know what I mean? Like, that's the first impression for a lot of these people. So production-wise, there were a lot of production, like TV production lapses this year. You know, there's nothing I can understand that justifies replay disasters at this stage of the game, you know, or you know, like we're watching a game and they're like, hey, sorry guys, we don't have review options, so the coach can't challenge now. Maybe that's something that happens the first year you introduce replay challenges, you know, and people are still trying to work their way around the technology and things like that. But something like that happening now, it just struck me as baffling. I wouldn't be able to explain that to someone who's casually watching, like, well, how come, like, they're challenging it, but then they, you know, the ref said, don't challenge it. How come? And it's like, well, they can't review it after all. I don't have answers for that sort of thing. So I mean, strictly on a production standpoint, that sort of thing needs to be tightened up and cleaned immediately.
Joe?
Yeah, I would say that this year, more than any year, or less than any year, I should say, we've seen fewer guys traveling to do the broadcasts. They've fallen back on local play-by-play and color guys, which has really hurt the broadcasts in Atlanta and Florida. And Florida has, like, great replay angles, probably up there right next to Denver as the best, like, inline cameras in the league. It, you know, produces some really great replays, like slow motion, where you can see the whole field and really break down a play, and we're just not really getting that game in and game out. I think the most enjoyable pair to listen to is Quentin Evan now. No more Kark and Amon. Well, Kark, but no more Amon. So the pair is gone. You know, I don't know if it's a matter of, like, the Twitter game of the week, at least, is the one where they fly guys to, but if you can get some of the guys like Ryan Boyle, who are really crushing it, at the college level, they're really enjoyable to listen to. And I think maybe not as much for us three, or other, like, diehards, probably pretty much everyone listening to this is, pretty diehard lacrosse fan, but for those casual fans, to convert them to a full-time fan, I think a great commentator can really tip the scales. The crews, you know, Boston, New York, Chesapeake, Rochester, like, op-eds are getting the best crews. So put those games on Twitter more, which stinks for the other team's fans, but you want to put the spotlight on the best broadcasts, which I think are happening in the organizations or in the cities with the organizations where that MLL team's been around the longest. And some of these newer teams, you know, they're just not ready for that Twitter game.
I actually absolutely agree on the broadcasters need to, I just think they need to be better. All of them, even, you know, Quint, Kark, and everybody, and Evan. And they're good. But, like, I want more professionalism out of every single broadcaster. I just do. Because I don't want to be the guy sitting at home being like, I can do this better than you. That's not what I want. They're like, I want people that I know are the best at what they're doing. And sometimes I would watch games and it would be an established name and they wouldn't even know like point totals or like what the guy did last game or anything like that. And it was annoying to me. So I agree, and I would go another step further that like the guys need to – if you're a broadcaster and you're watching – you're doing a game, you need to watch both teams play at least one game or the game before or two or three games. And I don't think anybody did that. And if they did, I didn't notice. Maybe the Denver crew did. You know, I know obviously John Bia Perel is a friend of mine. I'm sure he did. And a couple other guys did. But like by and large, this year, that was the most noticeable in league history to me. And I don't think there's an excuse for that. The other thing I thought you both were going to say that you kind of didn't say, but you touched on a little bit, was the cameras. Cameras are bad, man. Like you, this is like watching that Spanish soccer channel that tells you it's in HD, and you know it's not in HD. Like, don't lie to me. Don't lie to me. Tell me it's 720p, because it's not. You know what I mean? Like, Ohio in particular built this beautiful stadium. I'm sure it's amazing to watch games there in person. But I need a telescope to look at my computer to tell what's going on. Because the cameras are like on the moon. I don't get it. I don't know how you make all that investment and then, oh, we forgot where to put the cameras. Like we need to all push for better improvement in terms of the production of the games. And I think that starts with cameras and broadcasters. And replay is definitely something that I mean, that to me, I was just like, yeah, okay. I get it. It didn't shock me at all. The fact that I couldn't see numbers watching Ohio games was shocking. I was upset at that. And they actually zoomed in a little bit after in one of the Twitter games after a bunch of people, not just me, a bunch of people complained. But then the next game, they went back to shooting from far away. So you know, the MLO champion deserves people to watch their games and understand them and appreciate them. And it was really hard to do that. And I think they just need to fix that. Which brings us to the next point here. Direction. What does the new commissioner need to know? And what do they need to fix that they can fix simply? So obviously the league needs to make more money. They need more sponsors. That goes without saying. But what do you think their first goal is on day one when they get in there, Joe?
I think you got to know how important the players are to the league and how marketable some of these guys are. As we've seen more companies either get into the lacrosse industry or get back into, like Adidas, we've seen Miles Jones, Drew Snyder get signed to Adidas. We've seen String King sponsoring a lot of pros, like, newer companies are tapping into this space, which is allowing these guys to focus more on lacrosse and making your players more presentable to these brands so that even more of them can get sponsorships and maybe even sponsorships outside of the sport of lacrosse is really going to do wonders. So, you know, I don't know what it is, if it's more like off-field content, like String King is doing with their offhand series, or if it's like the All-Star game where the players take their helmet off right after they score a goal, they get some face time on the camera. I have no problem with that. It's tough to put a name to a face in a league where these guys are playing behind helmets a lot of the time. It's not like soccer or basketball where you do your hair up before a game and you know you're on the camera when you're at the free throw line or you're on the camera between the whistles in a soccer game. Getting these guys out there, pushing them out there, because the players are your product, and that's, you know, that's what's worked for the NBA. It's a superstar league, and it has been since Magic versus Bird, has been since Jordan, and it is today. So capitalizing on just the sheer amount of superstars that are in the league right now, like you were saying, it's the best generation of lacrosse players ever. There's few guys with their own line of products. And there are several dozen other guys who have personalities who are worth marketing and getting out there. So whether that's with video content or, you know, just pitching them to advertisers, setting these guys up for success and giving them the opportunity to devote more of their time to MLL by making them some more money.
Chris.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about the new commissioner, and I'm not sure if it's advantageous for it to be someone who's had his eye in the league. Maybe you guys have thoughts on this or not. Somebody who's been watching it and like getting a pulse for a few years, or somebody who comes in fresh and just knows about, you know, running large organizations with a sports theme or something of that nature. But either way, I think what the new commissioner needs to know is that this year, as far as PR goes, was not good. This was a lot of people with a lot of problems with the league, you know? Like, on-field was great. The players were great. The players above and beyond, you know, you always hear stories about, you know, this guy working at this camp or hanging out at this school, and you always see the pictures on Twitter. You know, this superstar stayed after the game for an hour, signed everything. Like, the players worked their butts off. But the people watching the games were especially vocal this year about the problems that were being, you know, just with the product as far as, you know, the league messed up on this or, you know, the gameplay messed up on this. And it's like, I think it's a good thing that the season ended when it did. Like, I think we need to go to our corners. You know what I mean? But the commissioner is going to inherit that situation. And I think they just need to kind of audit everything that goes into running a league, promoting its products, promoting its stars, basic, you know, communications, just announcements, rules. We just had a suspension come down. Is the suspension handled in the correct way? Is it assessed properly? Is it disclosed to the media and the fans properly? Like, every single thing, you just kind of have to lift it all up, assess it all, and then figure out what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong. And, like, I think the baseline for the commissioner should just be, you need to make something that you can be and should be proud of. And, like, if that's not happening, then you're doing it wrong. And I think that happens sometimes in this league. And I understand there's limited resources, limited time, limited finances, but you need to put something out there that you are proud of. And there can't be any sort of good enough. Because I think fans are going to have an expiration date when it comes to the benefit of the doubt. Like, you know, we're here because the players put on a great product. But as far as customers, you're getting people to open up their wallets and things like that. They're not going to stick around forever. They're not going to tolerate things forever if they're bad and don't shape up to head in a positive direction. So new commissioner just kind of needs to get out a checklist. What's working? What isn't working?
I absolutely agree with all of your points. As usual, I feel like there's going to be a lot of agreeing here. On my end, at least, you know, I have this vision of just like somebody just being a boss and walking in there and just firing everybody and hiring new people. And that might sound mean or whatever, but like Chris said, man, we are tired. Like, I don't want to be on Twitter like saying bad stuff about the PR department of the league. That's not what I want. I want them to be successful. I want them to be have a standard of standard. Need a standard, period. And it's not happening. I just want to see a change in the front office for the better. That's all. And maybe that doesn't entail firing everybody. Maybe that's too strong of a stance. But, like, something has to change. And if the new commissioner, whoever they may be, comes in and realizes that and makes a change the first day, I think we're on a better road. Because we are all going back to our corners as weary boxers, man. It's been a war out there this summer. And it shouldn't be like that for anybody. Everybody's content matters when it promotes the league. And that has not been the case with the league office. So that needs to change. And, you know, there needs to be a new standard established for what they put out in their own press releases, period. End of story, as far as I'm concerned. That brings us to our third part. We're gonna kind of give you some previews here of all these teams. Breaking right now, by the way, I know we're taping the podcast, but Joe, you're a Boston guy?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we just got Kyrie. No big deal. It's cool. It's so
do
great.
You like that, though?
I do. I'm smiling ear to ear. I think it's great. I don't like losing the guys we lost, but we're not going to talk about it anymore. I just wanted to get that out there because I'm so excited. Everybody's like, my phone's blowing up right next to me. But we're going to get into team by team. How does each organization in the MLL improve in the offseason? And we'll talk a little bit about which players had breakout seasons for each team. We're going to go alphabetically. No real favoritism here. We each chose three teams. There's nine teams. Up first, Chris with Atlanta. How does the organization improve, and which players had breakout seasons for the Blaze?
Well, you know, first of all, I think Atlanta trended in a positive direction. So that's good to see for the Blaze. Improvement in all aspects. I think they drafted well. I think they stuck, you know, had some guys stuck around. Supplemental, I think they did a great job there as well. As far as improving, they kind of have an issue some other teams have that you need to worry about when that identity is going to be formed. And having, you know, two of their three star attackmen being not only indoor players, indoor stars, but very successful ones, you know, if they're the last team like this past year, if they're, you know, facing off in the championship, you're not going to get them for a very long amount of time. They're going to have to almost establish an A team and a B team. We saw Florida with some success like that. You know, they had Chaz Woodson who worked out very well for them. They had guys like Jimmy Daly who came on and produced very well in their limited amounts of time that they were there, and then, you know, out with the old, in with the new. I think Atlanta kind of needs to take a page out of that book, maybe focus on, you know, who can we have to set the stage right away. And also, I think, you know, they just kind of need to worry about some midfield production. And I think a question they're going to be dealing with this offseason is the Scott Ratliff play the Band-Aid, or is that just his role from now on? Is he just a, you know, is he like never going to leave the field, or is that something they felt like they had to do? You know, it worked out well, but, you know, if you can get, say, a midfielder in there in his role, who's actually, you know, scoring more goals and not making, you know, defending the transition, which kind of brought, you know, the whole thing kind of started with them needing some transition defense, and they wanted to kind of, you know, make teams think twice about running on them. So they had, you know, Ratliff up there the whole time. But it's not necessarily a problem that every team faces, you know. So if they have another guy up there, like a 20-goal scoring midfielder, does Ratliff still have that role? So I think they're going to examine that in the offseason. But like I said, positive trends as well. As far as breakout players, Atlanta, I'd say you definitely have to go with James Pinnell. He had a great season for them. He's one of the guys came in early, ran some attack when needed, and then, you know, he headed up the midfield as well, 34 points. Last year, you know, when he was with the Lizards, didn't really fit in there, only played in four games. But, you know, this year, big offensive presence for him. So I would say he is by far the biggest breakout guy they had.
Up next, we got Joe addressing the team by team, how the organization improves, and which players had breakout seasons for the Boston Cannons. Take it away, Joe.
Yeah, so the breakout season for the Cannons has to be Kyle Jackson out of Michigan. It's, you would have to assume, is one of the reasons why they felt comfortable trading away Will Manny. Jackson's that lefty wing player, whether he's playing attack or coming out of the box. He's going to initiate from that same spot, right around where Manny used to operate. Whether Jackson's working the two-man game with Kevin Buchanan or dodging on his own, I actually think he's better playing in space, which is kind of weird to say about a traditional box player or Canadian. A lot of those guys like to run the pick and roll, Jackson is kind of an isolation heavy guy, so Boston seems very invested in him going forward. Does that pan out? What are the kind of guys that you need to put around him? I felt at times that the ball kind of stuck in his stick. He only had 18 assist opportunities as a shot created for a teammate. He took 31 shots off the dodge, so he's taking a lot more than he's creating for his teammates. When that's your primary initiator, kind of leaning more towards a guy who's going to take it for himself than get the offense going for his teammates, that's kind of a question mark. You got to really, you know, be one of those dominant shooters off the dodge, like a Jordan Wolfe, like a Miles Jones, who demands a slide if you're going to expect to start moving the defense and open up stuff for your teammates. So I think that's where we see Boston pick up next year. Kyle Jackson, as soon as he gets back from his indoor season, being their primary guy on the wing. You know, who do they bring in this offseason to pair with him? They have the number one pick, unless there's expansion. You know, two of the top guys in this draft, Ben Reeves, Connor Fields, both occupy that left-handed attackman spot. So they're both ball-dominant guys. Are they capable of running the pick and roll with Jackson? Do they make Jackson better? Do their touches take away from the exciting stuff that Jackson does with the ball in his stick? It's kind of the stuff that you got to find out in training camp. And the downside to Jackson being an NLL guy is that you don't get him for a full training camp. So they're going to learn who they are on the fly, and we'll see. It's a major question mark whether they can really create an offensive identity there in Boston.
I just got really excited when you started talking about Connor Fields in the MLL. I like blacked out, and that's all I heard. And I'm really pumped up for that now. That's going to be awesome. Moving on again, it's Joe again with the Charlotte Hounds. How do they improve, and which players had breakout seasons in Charlotte?
They got to improve defensively. I think offensively, they got a really nice balance with midfielders, with attackman. I love their top three midfielders and Kevin Crowley, Mike Janicek, John Haas. You know, even the fourth that they trot out of the box, whether it's Pat Young or Kevin Cooper, they have depth there. They can bring in John Crowley as kind of like an inverting midfielder. And their attack is obviously solid with Sankey, Rambo, and Ryan Brown. Just a great balance of dodgers and feeders and finishers and righties and lefties and guys who can, you know, create for themselves or play that two-man game. They all seem to gel together. I have no questions about Charlotte's offense. It's their defense that I'm worried about. You'd like to see them improve. You know, they lost Ryan Flanagan, one of their longtime guys on that defense, to New York last offseason. Michael Earhart's one of the great up-and-coming defenders in this league. I thought that their breakout guy, he's a rookie, so maybe unfair to call him a breakout guy, but Brendan Hines, he's going to be an all-ginger team candidate for years to come. Down low on defense, as soon as Hines got there, rookie out of Richmond, he kind of stabilized that defense, gave them, you know, a better cover than they had in the past. They have been one of the worst teams against guys like Rob Pinnell or Jordan Wolfe at X. They're the second worst defense in terms of efficiency defending behind the cage, which is tough because you're going to go against those Pinnells, Wolfs, Rices, guys like that, you know, almost every other week in this league. So if you can't defend behind the cage, you really can't defend in this league. And I like Hines. I'm not sure if he's the answer as that number one, but I feel like that's the position that Charlotte needs to address in either the draft or in player movement, is getting some guys down low who can play alongside Earhart and Hines.
Yeah, up next we got the Chesapeake BayHawks, and I'm going to take this one. You know, I think Chesapeake, you know, is a really good team. And they bordered on great, and the thing that kept them from reaching greatness, I feel, is consistency in the lineup. And this is something that, you know, you have a guy like Josh Byrne who comes in, wins MLL Rookie of the Year, and pumps in, you know, 39 goals. Like, that's not someone you luck into. That's someone you scout and you put them into your system. You know, same thing with Lyle Thompson. Lyle Thompson only played 6 games. You know, if you're going to focus on a consistent lineup, you need to have guys that are going to be there the whole season. And this is a problem for a lot of teams. I think Chesapeake is one of the teams that got a little bamboozled by some of these Canadian guys. This is a controversial stance. This is me saying this, not the views of the podcast or Inside the Cross or anything. So I want that to be clear. But I don't think it was fair to have all these, you know, Canadian guys come in and log major minutes and score major goals and help win games. And then, like, whew, gone. Like, we all know Worlds is next summer. Like, I get it. Like, get your money. I'm not saying don't get your money. But, like, I feel like GMs and coaches got to be a little smarter. And I think it really affected Chesapeake. I think having Thompson only play 6 games, why did you trade for him? He's going to play 6 games. That's not enough. It's really not enough to get the full, you know, for us to get the full Lyle experience. We want that. I want 10 games of Lyle Thompson in the MLL. I realize that's kind of not super feasible with the overlap of NLL and MLL, but I just feel like there needs to be more consistency in this roster. Obviously, I think their breakout player was Josh Byrne, and he will probably go very high in the NLL draft, and he will also miss time next year. So really, you're looking at leaning on Miles Jones, which they did earlier in the season, and then he wins the MLL All-Star Game MVP, and he really kind of dropped off production-wise because there are a lot more players to spread the ball around to. And my impression of Jones is, and this is not really a theory, it's just kind of watching him play for a while, I think he's so much better off the catch than he is trying to create his own shot. Because I think he has 20 dodges in his head that he wants to do, and then he does, like, tries to do 4 at the same time. And it doesn't always work out. Sometimes it's spectacular and amazing, but really if he commits to a downhill style where he can catch and go, I think he's going to be a monster, and he's going to live up to every, you know, piece of hype that has been thrown out there by everybody and anybody. I think their breakout player, in addition to Byrne as well, was Jake Furcaro. You know, just never seen a shooter with – he's like Pete Poyon with a – but he shoots more somehow. I don't even understand if that's possible, but – He's the guy that is going to take the heat check shot. And if it goes in, like, you're in for a long day playing defense on him, man. So I was really impressed with his play in the MLL. I talked to a couple of our colleagues at IL, Terry Foy in particular, was like, he's tailor-made. If any player is tailor-made for the MLL, it's Jake Furcaro. So I think they just need to get a little more consistent. I thought their defense is a little old. I think we need to bring in somebody who, not necessarily a lockdown guy, but a communicator. We need a guy that can really help out with that defense a little bit, because they were splitting time with goalies. And anytime you split time with goalies, you're going to experience, you know, even more tumult when you're adjusting to each one. So I feel like just more consistency, and Chesapeake is going to make the playoffs. I really think that if they get more consistent with the lineup and they fix some of their personnel problems in terms of guys showing up for 10 games, they're going to go really far. And Chesapeake had a good season, but disappointing ultimately in the end by missing the playoffs. Up next, we got Denver, and Chris is going to enlighten you on what they can improve and which players had breakout seasons for the MLL runners-up.
So here's the crazy thing about Denver. I noticed this the other night. You have a few of their guys. You've got your Sievers, your Snyder, your Mike Bocklet, who's kind of – I don't know how his age versus playing age it goes. You know, I don't know how that ratio is exactly. You kind of get that with football players a lot. Like, you know, Ricky Williams took a year off, so he's fresh, or, you know, Peterson or whoever. But, like – most of the guys on their roster who are doing serious damage are very, very young. This is like a rookie and second year team largely. You know, you're looking at like Kavanaugh and Berg, and this year you got Courier and Dennis and, you know, Kelly and Nick Osello. Like, all these guys can be there
for a very long time. So they don't really have much they need to shake up. I mean, especially won the championship last year, came close this year, you know, had one really bad quarter and then, you know, some scattered bad moments. But, you know, they don't really have to shake up that much, I would think, you know, as long as everybody stays in shape and, you know, stays hungry. I would say, I think, you know, draft, they're probably going to make, you know, specialized kinds of things more of a priority. They might, it depends on Larkin Kemp's availability, you know, what his job prospects is going to be, how, you know, how available he's going to be next year. Long stick midfield, are they going to incorporate him? Are they going to look for somebody else? They're still going to have Bocklet, but I don't know what they're going to do there. Short stick D midi, I think they'll probably bring in some competition there as well. But, you know, basically, like the anchors are in place for them to keep doing what they're doing years and years to come. I mean, Eric Law only has a few years under his belt, and they essentially have a team that they can just kind of keep rolling out. So, I mean, they should be fine. A breakout player, I would have to say somebody who really caught my eye this year in limited play was Ryan Ambler. Came on late, had 9 points in, like, his last four games. You know, it's tough to crack a roster like this offensively, but when, you know, Matt Cavanaugh went down with an injury and, you know, they had some time earlier in the year, some players were unavailable, they had guys who they were able to kind of squeeze in, and they always managed to shine when they were there. Ambler's probably the biggest example, but they just drafted so well that they could roll in new players, and they didn't miss a step. So, I mean, I guess if I have to pick one, I will pick Ambler, but, the team's going to be just fine.
Up next, we have Joe previewing Florida, what they need for next year, how they can improve, and which players had breakout seasons for the launch.
Kyle, you're not a fan.
What?
Loaded question. You've been outspoken about how you don't like the launch defense, correct?
I don't know. I think that's overblown. I don't like that they're young, and I do like Tucker Durkin, despite us screwing up and not putting him on the half-season list. I agree with that.
Sorry, Tucker.
That was messed up. Should have done that. That's messed up. I understand that viewpoint. I think they're too young. I think that they're and they move guys in and out. And again, the theme of consistency with Florida for me is very similar to Chesapeake, although Florida had a lot of their success early in the season. But long-winded answer. They're too young.
That's fair. Yeah. I mean, I felt like down the stretch they were a completely different defense. So for me, their breakout player was that entire unit. Because I gotta agree with you that we saw so many people early in the year who didn't necessarily play bad, but once they got their, you know, their core on defense, they drafted Newman. They drafted Tim Muller, didn't work out. Alec Tullett did work out. They have Liam Burns at LSM, and obviously Tucker Durkin down low. Once you get those guys kind of all playing on the same page, I thought they were one of the best defenses in the league down the stretch. In the 6-on-6, they were the second most efficient defense. And fast breaks, you know, they were abysmal. That's really where they got beat, let up a lot of their goals. I think as a young team, maybe with that young, you know, offensive midfield too, not necessarily getting back and fulfilling their role in transition. And as a, kind of a team that liked to run a little bit, they got run on. So I think that's where we saw them let up their goals. But you look at this defense, and I really can't help but be reminded by the Ohio defense when I look at Florida. Tom Mariano, head coach in Florida now, was the D coordinator in Ohio from 2013 to 2015 before spending 2016 with Chesapeake. And he really helped shape that defense that has been one of the best in the league for the last few years. Guys like Jackson Place, Matt McMahon, Stephen Waldeck, Brian Karalunas, all sliding on the same page. I think we saw Florida kind of fly around, play that way a little bit, hold their slides at the right times, and then go when necessary. I think the one missing piece that's their path to improvement, is finding a short stick like Dominique Alexander. Because if you want to slide on defense, there's going to be two things that open up. You know, skip lanes are going to open up, and you're going to change your matchups constantly. So as good as Mike Unterstein was, he was physical this year. I thought Mark McNeil was good. In the time that he got, they picked up John Yazoo Scaparato late. He was, you know, he was attacked by a lot of opposing teams. They're still searching for that lockdown short stick middie, which, you know, I'm not sure there's another one out there like Dominique Alexander. Ohio trusts him to cover so many different types of guys. In the championship game, biggest stage of the season, we saw him covering Westberg, who's more of a bold dodge, kind of bruiser on the wing. We saw him covering Romar Dennis, a guy who's going to left to right split or right to left split, get that two-way go up top and kind of beat you with speed. So Dominique Alexander and his ability to cover all those different types of dodgers is really what Florida needs. If they can find a short stick like that, then I feel like it will enable their poles to play the way that they want to defensively. And, you know, next year, year after, I wouldn't be surprised if Mariano has kind of replicated the unit that he helped build in Ohio down there in Florida with Launch.
All right. All fair points. I think finding that, I think the only other guy that's close to Alexander for me is Molnar. And I think he was a little banged up towards the end of the year. You saw that in the champ game. I'm going to take the New York Lizards. Where do I start here? You have so much offensive talent that I might like you not score. I'm talking to you as an organization, just New York Lizards as a personified like being in the world. You have so much talent. And every time you don't score, like a single tear runs down my cheek and into my mouth, and I don't like it. I want you to score. You have all these pieces. You fleeced Will Manny away from the Cannons, and you didn't even need him. Like, you've done all of these things to try and win the championship and have another go and make a dynasty, and now you don't have Greg Gerenlian. You got to get a faceoff guy, and you got to get two more poles that can play defense and defend two-man, and also maybe, I don't know, get back on a break or handle the ball. Because you don't really have any of those, to be honest. I think Fletcher's the best defenseman there. Obviously, they love Austin Pafani. I don't think he's much of a ball carrier, but, you know, defensively as a one-on-one guy, he's very above average in the league. But I don't see anybody else on that defense sticking around and playing more than five games for that team next year. They need a complete overhaul. There's no excuse for that team not scoring 15 goals a game this year or next year. Even if they lose four guys out of that lineup of offensive players, they should be able to score 15 goals, because that actually might be the answer. That might be the answer. Move a ton of guys out. Just move a ton of guys out, trade for some established poles, guys that don't mind covering twos and covering quick guys, because you don't have anybody that can really do that outside of Fletcher. So I just feel like that's what they need to do. In terms of breakout season, Will Manny, is that fair? Is that a cheat? I feel like I'm cheating. Like, you got the best player from another team and added him to your team. And he did great. I mean, he didn't really have an assist until like the second to last game of the season. He was more of a finisher and kind of an off-ball guy moving around in that lefty spot. But, I mean, he played great. He's a great player. It made Boston look even dumber than they did before. So, you know, that's the move. Hopefully he stays there with his future with Utah. We'll figure that out when it comes in the offseason. But, you know, New York – got a lot of work too in the offseason. You got to replace maybe the best faceoff guy in the history of the league, at least of this era. And you have to get a lot more long poles that can actually play defense. So it's going to be a long summer for the Lizards. But I think if they move enough guys out, clear enough, you know, I can't believe I'm saying this. They clear enough cap space, because there is a cap for salary. If they can clear enough cap, they can get some great defenders in there and play some solid defense, which they did not do for most of the season. Up next, we have Chris talking to you about your 2017 MLL champion, Ohio Machine.
Well, like you just said, and like we're all well aware, they won the championship. So they get to start from there. But obviously, some things are going very well for them. I think one aspect that they're going to have to look at in the offseason, and it's tough because his last impression was so good, but, you know, they're getting hammered for it all year. The faceoffs were a problem. So you know, when you're trying to fix faceoff, you're going to obviously look at the faceoff position, but you also have to look at how you're setting up on it. You know, who's playing on the wings, not necessarily replacing the players who play on the wings, but, you know, maybe you do need to have different players in those roles. Maybe they're getting tired from playing more consistent LSM work, whatever. The whole sort of package has to be examined. But I think obviously they're going to start, looking, just bringing in some competition for Greg Piskulgin. See how he's going to do with that. The team as a whole, a lot of very good players. You know, we were just talking about Dominic Alexander, and I mean, you just look at it top to bottom, the roster stack. I would think a concern, if any of these guys would have concerns, and they're still young players for the most part, so I don't think that would be it. But I would be curious about outside interests. You know, you do have Holman playing for Utah. I mean, coaching at Utah. So he's definitely going to be staying involved in lacrosse. But, you know, I heard earlier this year, I think Matt Kinnear tweeted it out, talking about Brian Karlunas after game. He caught a red eye and, you know, had to get back to the law firm where he works. And I don't know, you know, especially for people with, like, West Coast ties, I know Ohio isn't, you know, as bad as, say, you know, playing in Long Island or something like that. But I wonder if someone in, say, Carolina's position, or someone like Peter Baum, you know, a Western person, after a while, if that's going to take a toll, and, you know, the commute going to take a toll, especially this sense of accomplishment having reached this pinnacle. I wonder if you look at it differently now. You know, so I think some people get the hunger to, you know, oh, we got to do it again. Let's keep the group together. Let's keep fighting. How many of these can we win? But I think some other people probably look at that same situation and say, yes, I made it. You know, and then you reassess, okay, you know, I did a great job. We all came together and we had, you know, what a perfect end to a perfect campaign. You know, maybe now I'm not going to take these, you know, 4 a.m. flights so I can get back to work. So I think theirs is a team that, I think partially based on the personnel and partially based on the location, is a team that's going to be faced with that sort of thing. Maybe not this off season, but maybe, you know, a year from now or something like that. As far as breakout players, I know Mark Cockerton was kind of highly recognized for like, you know, his most improved sort of elements, and same with Kyle Burnlore. I guess maybe it's necessary for that award, but I also think it's kind of silly. I don't think Kyle Burnlore is one of the most improved players. I think he was phenomenal. I mean, he was phenomenal in college. He didn't start his first year, and I think that's what it came down to. I think he was great this year, you know, had more of those kind of patented Burnlore flying all around saves, you know, made great stops, you know, the ones you expect, and then, you know, made the ones you don't necessarily expect as well. So yeah, I think he has been a stellar goalie as long as I've known who Kyle Burnlore was. So I'm not surprised by his play. Mark Cockerton, I talked to Peter Baum and Kyle Harrison for a thing I wrote about Ohio last week. And I asked them about Cockerton's game, and I was like, do you think that his game is evolving, or it's just kind of the product of him having that spot all to himself? You know, he doesn't have John Garrett Jr. there. It's just, it's his and his alone. And they both answered the same. They were like, you know, he's been really good for a long time. Like, it's actually impossible to compliment Mark Cockerton without it sounding like an insult, because it's like, well, were you watching last year? You know, were you watching, you know, the years before? He's been a monster. He's just a monster more often now. So even him, I'm not going to say breakout player. I have to give it to Jake Bernhardt, just because his role changed so drastically this year. You know, Tom Schreiber not being there, and then they had, you know, Kyle Harrison with the injury. They needed someone to step up, and they just gave it to him. And he had, you know, he had scored previously, but, you know, obviously had more of a defensive role. But this year they entrusted him to kind of run the offense there and, you know, smooth everything over until the rest of the team could fully assemble. And he did that. You know, 34 points this season, you know, his season was a little bit derailed, but they knew he was actually going to come back, and they were all, you know, very excited, knowing, you know, if we can just keep things going until Jake gets back, we'll actually have this team at its full capacity. So I would say Jake Bernhardt is my Ohio Machine breakout player of the year.
Ohio Machine fans, you can send your hate mail to Chris on Twitter at ChrisRosie22. They're going to be so mad you said people are going to pick their roster off, man. They're going to be so upset with you.
I didn't say that people were going to pick their roster up.
Are you sure? Because I feel like you did. It was great. I loved it. I love a hot take. Speaking of hot takes, I'm going to take Rochester / Dallas, question mark. I think that Rochester, if they're going to move, I don't know why they didn't announce it at MLB Championship in Dallas, if they're moving to Dallas, which we thought they were last fall, that's a developing situation. They do not have a stadium to play in next season. Then again, they didn't have a stadium to play in this season until about a week before the league started. So, baby steps. Rochester, you know, the thing about Rochester is as long as they stay in Rochester and they have Tim Sudan as their coach, I don't think that they're going to miss the playoffs. And it's a matter of believing in him and how he manages his players, because I think he is the best player manager in the entire league by far. And I say that because if you talk to people that used to play for Rochester, they don't whine about fans not being there or people that – you know, they don't whine about playing time or anything like that. They're just like, oh, it was cool to play for Sudo. Like, that's a game changer for me. And, you know, their season was up and down. At points, they looked unbeatable. And then at end of games, they would have complete brain farts and, like, run out of bounds or, like, have a box penalty. I think we all know how I feel about box penalties, like, inexcusable. And they lost two games from box penalties and one from a guy running out of bounds because he didn't know where the line was. Like, mental errors that need to be corrected. But if those mental errors are corrected, I think they win at least two of those three games and then are in a better position come playoff time. Breakout player for me, this is like the easiest thing ever, and not just because he's a Shire boy. Drew Simino, monster. Just, and I've said this, I've had to correct my description here. Greatest public school player in New Hampshire history in the MLL. Just a phenomenal season, over 100 ground balls. He can actually, he's not a great shooter, but he's not terrible. You know, he had four goals. He had two assists. He knows what to do. He's so clutch on draws. I can't remember a more clutch player winning a draw when games were close than Drew Simino all season long. I thought that he should be in the running for Team USA. That's how good I thought he played this season. So, and if one of those Team USA guys gets hurt, heaven forbid that happens, I think Drew Simino needs to be the first call. Easily the breakout player for the Rattlers for me. And that is actually going to bring us to the end of our team-by-team segment. We had a couple more things planned, but we're running short on time. I wanted to ask you guys one thing, and it's kind of a workshoppy thing. We're in the media. We work for various media outlets. We've freelanced. All three of us have freelanced. I'm currently working at Inside the Cross. That's where you're hearing this podcast coming from. What can we do better in the offseason for the MLL? What can we do to give them the attention they deserve, to convince people that this league is legit and to give it all of their attention? Like, what can we do? And I'll ask Joe first.
That's a great question. And, you know, it's something that the second that that final whistle blows for the championship game, I constantly find myself thinking about this every year. I think that last year we took steps towards this, and, you know, this year we'll take even more. It's just become like a 365-day per year brand. Right now, while we're recording this podcast at, you know, we're 3 days, like 72 hours removed from MLL season, but still pretty much like we're in MLL season. Kyrie Irving for Isaiah Thomas trade is going down. Like, the NBA has no off season. It's crazy. Obviously we can't pull the trigger on trades or signings. But, you know, covering this stuff as it unfolds and as it impacts, these teams on the field, I think with player movement, you know, it gives us more space on the calendar, because in years past, you could kind of cover MLL, tune in April or March or April, and then tune out this time of year, mid-August, and just go watch football. So now that player movement and potentially expansion or relocation is upon us in the fall, I think there's going to be a lot to discuss. Just got to keep grinding and, you know, talking about all those changes, because like we touched on earlier, every team is one off season away. So I really do think that a couple moves are very pivotal, whether it be, a coaching change, like what happened in Florida last year, to really propel them to the top, or whether it's a team that had a poor culture, bringing in the right leaders like Ohio did when they brought in Tom Schreiber, and they had Scott Rogers and Marcus Holman, and those guys are their captains. That's what changed the team. So, you know, starting in about a month when player movement gets going, all through the NCAA draft, there's going to be these opportunities for these teams to add those one or two or three pieces that they need to compete for the 2018 MLL championship.
Chris, what do you think?
You know, I don't know. It's a really good question. I guess it largely comes down to, you know, how you feel you did this year, and then where you go from there. As far as how to, you know, promote the league, I'm not really sure, because, like, that's definitely not our job. You know, they, I'm sure, appreciate it if we do, but
some of them do.
Right. Yeah. So I was going to say, like, even that, I'm not entirely sure. I don't want to speak for them and assuming that they appreciate it if we do. So it's a really good question. How to improve? I mean, we all kind of have to be self-propelling units. You know, this isn't, at this stage, it isn't something that just, you know, if media people stop talking about it, you know, we've definitely kind of reached a point where there might not be anything presented to anyone else, you know. The game's being done. We're about to hit kind of a dead period. So I think it's all kind of like I was saying with the commissioner who comes in, it's kind of internal motivation. You know, everybody looks at what they did in the past season and, you know, how can they churn off a better product for next year? Obviously starting as soon as possible. If you have a good time or you feel like you fulfilled your obligations as a journalist or a writer, then by all means, crank it up a bit more. I think once you get into a situation that you like what you're doing, you can just do more of it. And hopefully people who read our stuff and, you know, listen to this podcast, for example, if they like it, then it's all going to kind of generate, keep turning onto itself. And I think the league starts at the top of that. If they have some things going on and there's going to be a demand to hear about them, then if we're all in good positions, hopefully we will continue to turn things along. Improving like the league or something like that is up to the league. You know, I don't work for the league. You know what I mean? Like, hopefully they put themselves in a great position and we can take advantage of the great position they put themselves in. But it's kind of like this, like, and this is probably one of the more cynical takes I promote, but like, I drive a Dodge, right? And I think it's great. I would recommend it to everybody else. But like, if the tire falls off every 1,000 miles, I can't keep telling you that Dodges are dope. And I think that's the situation we're in right now. Like, if the top of this thing keeps going great and getting better and better and better, then our jobs are going to be easier and easier and easier. And people who are fans are going to have way more fun. So as far as this offseason goes, I think the offseason is kind of a pivotal time for everybody. For us, you know, I said the league and the commissioner, the structure, everything. I think things can go in a really great direction, but they don't necessarily have to. So my fingers are crossed that they do, but we'll see.
Yeah, both great viewpoints. You know, it was hard. This was a hard summer, man. It was a hard summer to be media, and not in the way it's like, oh, I'm breaking rocks. It was hard kind of way. It was just hard to get anything done. And I had to start turning to players instead of teams, instead of the league. And the players are the ones that got me what I needed to help me write what I needed to write. And I'm very thankful for that, because there are plenty of MLL players and ex-MLL players that would love to punch my head in. And that's fair. That's fine. It's cool. There's a lot of lacrosse fans that would like that too. But the thing is, like, everything I try to do for the MLL, I do it because I genuinely love it. And that sounds crazy, because I am the most vocal critic when they screw up. And I do that because I do love the league. And I know that if they keep screwing up, like Chris said, the tires keep falling off. I can't keep telling people the car's great. And I want to. There's something more I want in the world. I want everyone to be an MLL fan that's a lacrosse fan. I want people that don't even watch college lacrosse to watch MLL and know that MLL is the best iteration of lacrosse. I want them to know that. I want them to know that those players are the best. And the only thing I can point to that people even, you know, see as an example of that is like when Team USA beats the bag off of an NCAA team, which happened, you know, in 2015 when they crushed Denver, you know, and no one's talking about that. All MLL players, whatever, it's fine. You know, it's a matter of, again, Joe said it, like, promoting the players is the way to get the league to grow. Promoting the teams is not, or the league itself is not the way to go. It's more about promoting the players. And I can tell you right now, that's my mandate going forward. My self-imposed mandate is to promote more players, do more player profiles, and do more analysis of those players that will bring people to games to watch them play lacrosse, which is what they love to do. So in terms of, you know, stuff that we can do, that's what I want to do. I don't know how often I'm going to get to do that given the rigors of the rest of, you know, my official job, which is, by the way, not MLL editor or MLL anything. It just so happens I have a history with it and they let me do it. You know, it's a privilege to cover these players. And I just want the league to live up to them. And with a new commissioner, hopefully that happens. Hopefully more money comes in and we see the league blossom into a real professional league where it's all you can do is just, you get paid to play lacrosse. Wouldn't that be great? You know, and I would love to have a role in that to help those players. I think it's important to take the ownership of that. For all of us in the media to just be like, it's not about us. It's about the game. It's about the players. And that's what everybody needs to do going forward that covers the MLL, that likes the MLL. I just feel like we're all obligated in a certain way to give the players the stage to shine on, because you can't always see it when the league does it. So I would like to try and help do that. But that is going to bring this podcast, the MLL Champ Recap and off-season kind of review, to an end. We want to thank Joe Keegan for sticking around for the whole pod. Thanks a lot, man. Really appreciate it. You can check him out on MoneyballLacrosse.com. What's your Twitter handle?
At Joe Keegs.
Or at Joe Keegs. And obviously, Chris, where can people find you?
Find me on Twitter at ChrisRosie22.
And you can follow me on Twitter at TheKyleDevitt and also on Instagram, although I'm taking a long break from social media in September. So good luck. Get your shots in now. And thanks for tuning in to the MLL podcast. We will see you later. X gon' give it to you. Wait for you to get it on your own. X gon' deliver to you. Knock, knock, open up the door and spill. With the nonstop pop out from stainless steel. Go hard getting busy with it. But I got such a good heart that I make the mother.